screen door into the house. My friend Leonard is alive. Windows are wide open. Motherfucker disappeared for 18 months, didn't say shit about where he was or what he was doing. I thought he was dead. Curtains fluttering. He's alive. I hear the faint sounds of classical music. Bella's on a leash. We walk to the door. I press the bell. I wait. I see movement. I smile. My friend Leonard is alive. A man comes to the door. He's not Leonard. He looks like he's about 30. He's tall, thin, has short blonde hair parted to one side. He's wearing khakis, black leather sandals, a white Oxford. He looks very clean. He stands at the door, speaks in a bitchy, effeminate way.
May I help you?
Leonard here?
How may I help you?
I have the postcard in my back pocket. I take it out, hold it up. I got this postcard in the mail. It has this address on the back. I thought it might be from my friend Leonard.
May I see it?
Sure. He opens the door enough for me to pass him the card. He looks at it, looks back at me, speaks.
Your name is?
James.
He motions to Bella. And who is that?
Bella. He looks at Bella, speaks.
Hi, Bella.
She wags her tail.
Isn't there another one? Cassius?
He died.
I'm sorry.
It sucked.
I'm sure it did. I know you loved him.
Who are you? He opens the door.
My name's Freddy. I sent you that card. We've been waiting for you.
Is Leonard here?
Yes.
I step inside the house. There are pristine, pale wood floors. All of the furniture is white. There are thick, soft, white couches and chairs. There are impressionist prints on the walls. There are flowers everywhere. Freddy leads me through the foyer, the living room. I can see a deck. I can see Leonard, or what appears to be a faded version of Leonard, sitting on a chaise lounge on the deck. He's wrapped in a white cotton blanket. As I walk toward him, he turns to me. He smiles, lifts his hand, speaks. His voice is weak and scratchy.
My son has arrived.
I walk onto the deck. Freddy stays behind, leaves us alone. I look at Leonard. I'm shocked, speechless. He's lost 30 or 40 pounds. There are open sores on his arms and neck. His hair looks dry and brittle. His skin is gray and sallow. He looks like he hasn't eaten in a month, like a skeleton, like a dead man. The only thing that remains unchanged are his eyes, which are clear and fixed, dark brown, alive.
My son, you found me.
I'm happy to see him, but shocked. I smile. You sent for me. I lean down to hug him.
You don't have to touch me if you don't want to.
Fuck that, Leonard. He laughs. I give him a hug, a strong hug. He feels small and fragile in my arms, feels like a child. He's skin and bones, smells like medicine, sickness, decay. He hugs me back. His arms are weak, incredibly weak. It's good to see you, Leonard.
My son, it's good to see you too.
I pull away. Bella puts her front legs on the edge of the lounge, kisses Leonard's hand. He looks down at her, smiles.
Oh, Bella, you little angel.
He leans down. She kisses his face.
Where's your brother? Where's the big boy?
He died. Leonard looks up. He looks hurt.
What happened?
I shake my head. Leonard speaks.
Bad?
Yeah.
And how's Allison?
I laugh. That was bad too.
She's okay, isn't she?
I assume so, though I haven't spoken to her in a while.
Big changes, my son.
I've been through worse, but it wasn't fun.
Big change never is.
Looks like you're experiencing some big changes, too. He laughs.
That's one way of putting it.
What's going on here, Leonard? He laughs.
What's going on? Isn't that the fucking question?
You look fucking awful. He laughs, coughs, speaks.
Pull up a chair.
I look around the deck. There are a couple of other chairs. I pull one of them over, sit down.
You want the long version or the short version?
I'm not going anywhere. He laughs, coughs. The cough gets worse. I look at him and I'm scared. I put my arms around him, pat him on the back. He stops coughing. I pull away. He spits something unpleasant off the deck and into the yard. He laughs, speaks.
Pretty nice, huh?
What's wrong?
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. He looks at me, takes a deep breath.
I'm gay and I am dying of AIDS.
I look at him. I don't know what to say. He speaks.
You okay?
I nod. Yeah.
I'm gay, my son, and I'm dying of AIDS.
I heard you.
Surprised?
That would be one way to put it.
You can leave if you want.
Why would I leave?
I don't know what your position is on being gay, and I don't know what your position is on AIDS.
My position is that you're my friend, and if you're gay, you're gay. It doesn't make any difference to me. And if you've got AIDS, I'm sorry, and I'm going to do whatever I can to help you. He smiles.
Thank you, my son.
You gonna give me the long version or the short version? He smiles again, looks away, looks out across the deck. He closes his eyes, takes a deep breath as if he's gathering strength, looks back.
I've always known. For as long as I've had memories, I've known. When I was a kid, I liked playing with girls more than boys, and liked looking at boys more than girls. At the time, I didn't know what that meant, though I did know that in a Roman Catholic Italian family, it wasn't considered right. As I grew up, got older, whatever it was I felt got stronger, and I had to work harder to ignore it. I went on dates. When I was old enough, I slept with women. I got engaged a couple of times, and just kept putting the weddings off. Although I love women, I love their company and their beauty, and could perform with them, I just couldn't follow through because it wasn't right for me. All the way through, I overcompensated for what I felt, which was a love for men, by being the meanest, craziest, most violent motherfucker anybody knew. That way nobody could question me or doubt me or even suspect me, because a person who did some of the things I did could never be a fairy, even though I was. And I am. What happened, because of the world I lived in, was that my violence made me more respected, and ultimately, more successful. That success locked me into my charade even more, because I was around more people, and they watched me more carefully. I was in my early 20s the first time I slept with a man. He was a cab driver in New York. We were driving, talking, and he could tell somehow. And he propositioned me, and I accepted. And it happened in the back of his cab, which we parked in an alley. I hated myself for it. Fucking hated myself. And I'd hated him for being with me. I knew, though, that I would do it again. And I did. Over and over and over for the rest of my life. Always with random men in random places. Always with men who had no idea who I was or had any connection to me. I kept hating myself for a while. Then I just accepted what I was. And I also accepted that I could never be open about it. If I was ever open, or if I got caught, I would get killed, because my business doesn't allow for weakness. Even though being gay isn't weak, that would have been the perception. Violent men, criminals, people like me, would never have allowed or tolerated or trusted or respected me. And at the first chance they got, they'd have put me in the fucking ground. Somewhere along the way, I picked up HIV. I have no idea from whom or when. About 6 years ago, I woke up one day and I felt like something was wrong. So I took a test and it came back positive. When I got the result, I left the doctor's office and I never went back. I know there are things I could have done with a doctor and drugs and combinations of drugs I could have taken to slow down the virus. And at this point, they say there are things that can almost stop it. But if I'd started going to a doctor and had gone on a drug regimen, people would have found out. And again, if my associates had found out, they would have killed me. I started thinking about what I have done, and I'll explain exactly what I've done soon. A few months after I met you and after you met Lily. I remember very vividly you telling me about Lily's desire to feel free from her addictions and the hell of her life, and her telling you that to her, a second of freedom was worth more than a lifetime of bondage. I thought about that every day. Every fucking day. And then I started watching you, and watching how you took responsibility for the mess you had made of your life, and how you rejected everything you were told would save you in favor of what you believed, which was that you had the power to make the decisions that would decide the course of your existence. What I learned from the two of you was that freedom is worth sacrifice, and that I was in charge of my life and how I lived it, and that I could decide to do anything I wanted to do. I wanted to escape and be free. Free of my job, of my position, of my role. I wanted out of the prison I built around myself. I wanted to get the fuck out. I started taking steps to do it when you were in Chicago. I knew the virus would get me sooner or later, so I was on a time schedule. My plan was to try to legitimize some of my businesses so that I could make more money and hide it easier. I also read that if I started living better by exercising, eating properly, and living as cleanly as possible, it might slow the virus down. That's what all my diets were about. All my exercise plans. And I don't know if they did anything or not. Once the virus started mutating, I was going to disappear, which is what I did. So that, before I died, I could live part of my life as a normal gay man. Albeit a normal gay man who was dying of AIDS. That's what I've been doing since I last saw you. First thing I did was get a fake passport and leave the country. I knew once I was gone that people would be looking for me, though not because I was gay, they probably still don't know that, but because I disappeared with a big pile of money. I knew if they found me, they would kill me. Being far away, where no one knew me or would recognize me, was important. I went to London, Paris, Rome, Athens, Madrid, Moscow, and St. Petersburg. I looked at beautiful art, and saw the sights, and went to gay bars at night, and looked at beautiful men. I went to India and saw the Taj Mahal. Went to China and saw the wall. Went to Japan and saw all sorts of weirdness. After 7 months, I came back to the States and settled here. I've been very careful since I've been here. I don't usually go out during the day. When I go out at night, I go to gay bars and restaurants with a predominantly gay clientele. I've been out on a few dates. I fell in love briefly. I've done some of the things I've always dreamed of being able to do. Over the course of time, I've also gotten sicker and sicker. As you can see, I'm not in good shape. I hesitated to contact you until recently because I didn't want you followed, and I'm sure at various points over the last year and a half you have been watched very carefully. Snapper, who is a wonderful man, but who is also a man with a nasty job that he does very well, would have known that you might be able to lead him to me. And that's probably what he's been doing since I left, trying to find me and kill me. I don't have much time left. If you leave when I'm finished talking, I'll understand. And I'll be grateful for you for coming at all. What I did was fucked up. But it's what I did to complete my life. To be able to die happy. Now that I've seen you, I have only one thing left on my list of things to do before I die. Which is play the golf course where my father worked and where I promised him I would play. To pull up, park my car in the lot, walk through the front door, and play that fucking course just like one of the members. I know that isn't going to happen. And if that's all I haven't done, I'm fine with it.
Leonard stops speaking, slumps into his chair as if speaking has taken all of his strength. I look at him, broken and dying, wasting away, sores all over his body, wrapped in his blanket. He looks at me, I speak. A lot of things make more sense now.
Like what?
No wife, no girlfriends, your love of clothes and white cars. Why, all of my girlfriends, romantic and platonic, wanted to be your best friend. The house in Laguna Beach, which is a gay town, that I thought you loved because of the view. Why, you said Allison, who drops jaws everywhere she goes, wasn't your type. The Speedo bikini you used to wear when you went swimming. He laughs.
The signs were there. It's fucking amazing nobody ever figured it out. And I still have that suit.
I understand it now. He laughs again. It is a weak laugh.
Straight or gay, I stick to my guns on it. It's for swimmers, Europeans, and motherfuckers with style.
I laugh. I'm still not any of them.
Your loss. Someday you'll realize. Your loss.
Is Freddy your boyfriend?
No. Though in a different situation I might want him to be. He's my caregiver. A nurse of sorts. He helps me deal with what's happening to me.
I look at him. I'm sorry, Leonard.
For what?
I'm sorry you had to live like that for so long. Sorry that you had to hide. And I'm sorry that you're dying.
I chose how to live as I've lived, and I'm choosing how to die as I'm going to die. You shouldn't be sorry. If anything, I should be sorry for keeping the secret from you and for disappearing on you.
No apology necessary.
Thank you.
Is there anything I can do?
Hang out with me. That's all I want. Some time with my son.
That's why I'm here.
Thank you, James. Thank you.
Freddy orders lunch from an Italian restaurant. He sets up a table on the deck. We have mozzarella and tomato, pappardelle with boar ragu, veal chops,
Gelato. I eat like a pig. Leonard hardly eats at all. He feeds most of his lunch to Bella, pretends to eat the rest by pushing his food around the plate. I ask him about his travels. He smiles, calls for Freddy, asks him to get his books. Freddy brings out a stack of books, sets them on a table. There are a few art books, a couple of photo albums, 4 or 5 weathered travel guides. Freddy starts to walk away. Leonard speaks.
Don't you want to look at them with us?
Freddy turns around, smiles. You've shown them to me about 75 times, Leonard. I think I can skip this viewing. They both laugh. Freddy goes back into the house. Leonard stares at the books for a moment, smiles. He reaches for one of the travel guides.
Move your chair over here, my son.
I move my chair so that I'm sitting next to him.
We'll start with London.
London is a good place.
A great place. Much, much better than I expected. Everyone says the food is bad and that the English have terrible teeth. But I ate like a king and saw plenty of nice choppers.
I laugh.
And the accents. They're everywhere. Wonderful British accents.
Laugh. He opens the book. Opens one of the photo albums. There's a large picture of him at a stadium surrounded by fans in red and white jerseys, with banners, hats, horns, and beers.
I open to Wembley, where I saw the FA Cup final, which is sort of like the English version of the Super Bowl.
For soccer?
Yes, for soccer, though they call it football.
How was it?
Great. They're crazy about their football. They have to keep the fans of the team separated by big fences or they'll attack each other. They make our fans look like poodles.
He keeps flipping through the books, opening a passage in a guidebook to a corresponding photo. He starts showing me the highlights of his trip to London. He shows me his hotel, the Covent Garden, which he calls delightful. He reads me a passage about his favorite restaurant, which is the oldest fish and chip stand in the city. He talks about the London Dungeon Museum. There were fucking rats running in circles around the Iron Maiden. About the British National Museum. Half of civilization under one big fucking roof. About the National Portrait Gallery and the Tate. My, oh my, they took my breath away. He talks about the weather. It sucked, but I didn't mind. About the friendly disposition of the city. It's like a cleaner, nicer version of New York. He closes London. We work our way through France. He says France is like a beautiful woman who knows she's beautiful. Some people will love her beauty and arrogance. Some people will hate it. Leonard loves it. Says he spent 2 weeks wandering aimlessly around Paris drinking coffee and shopping and watching people and looking at the antique stands along the Seine. He spent 2 days in the Louvre, and 2 in the D'Orsay. He spent another at the Musée Rodin. He ate every meal in a different restaurant, would just stop as he walked, pick places at random. He was never disappointed. We move through the rest of Western Europe. He says, I loved it all. Loved it all. We move to Eastern Europe. He says, man, it's wonderful over there. We should have never been enemies with those people. We skip Italy. He says he has another book for that part of the trip. I ask him if there's anything he didn't like about Europe. He says the Greeks were mean and the weather in Russia sucked. Other than that, I fucking loved it all. He opens the Asian guides, starts taking me through his Indian trip. He says India is a different world, one every American should be required to visit so that we understand how fortunate we are and how stupid we are. He says that despite the crushing poverty, the people are happy and hopeful and optimistic. And despite our own ludicrous wealth, we're depressed and unsatisfied and pessimistic. He talks about the cities. You can't believe how many fucking people there are. The food. It gave me the fucking shits. The art. It's all religious, totally simple and pure. Like early Renaissance art, which may never have been exceeded. He says the Taj Mahal, the greatest and most magnificent monument to love the world has ever seen, is a fitting symbol for the country as a whole. We open the book on China. He tells me about Beijing. It's huge and dirty, and it smells, and there are bikes everywhere. The wall, it's so cool, I can't even fucking believe it actually exists. The Forbidden City, it makes every other palace in the world look like a steaming pile of dog shit. He tells me about Japan. It's weird and noble and somehow simultaneously stuck in the past and in some version of the future. It's like everything is turned up to 11. We finish with the guidebooks and the photo albums. The last picture in the album is of a smiling Leonard sitting at a table with a group of 500-pound sumo wrestlers. There is enough food to feed 50 people. Leonard is still Leonard wherever he goes under whatever conditions. I laugh at the picture. He closes the albums. He reaches for the art books, speaks.
Are you ready?
For what?
God, beauty, love, perfection in multiple forms.
I motion to the books. In those books?
He nods. In these books.
That's a tall order, Leonard. He smiles.
Order filled.
He opens the first book. The text is in Italian. There isn't much of it. Leonard stops talking, starts slowly turning the pages. The pages are filled with color reproductions of paintings, frescoes, altars. I don't know or recognize many of the paintings, though I do recognize the names. Botticelli, Da Vinci, Caravaggio, Correggio, Ghirlandaio, Raphael, Tiepolo, Tintoretto, Titian. We spend a couple of minutes on each page. Sometimes Leonard will say where the piece exists. The Uffizi, Galleria Borghese, Santi Apostoli, the Pope's rooms at the Vatican. Sometimes he'll point to a small detail, a drifting lock of hair, the reflection of a glass, a shading, a shadow, the look of a face. We close the first book. Leonard carefully sets it apart from the guidebooks and photo albums. He opens the second book, which is on the work of Michelangelo. He moves more slowly through the pages, some of which appear to be stained in some way. We see the Pietà, David from 20 angles. We see the sketches for the tomb of Julius II, the plans and corresponding photographs of the Laurentian Library. There is a page for each of the panels of the Sistine Chapel. The entire ceiling is spread across two pages. There are pages devoted to the details of the Last Judgment. The entire wall is spread across two pages. As we stare at the Last Judgment, tears start falling onto the pages. Leonard doesn't bother to wipe them away.
God, beauty, love, perfection in multiple forms.
We stare at the pages and tears fall from Leonard's cheeks. God, beauty, love, perfection in multiple forms. I stay at Leonard's house. Bella and I stay in a guest room on the second floor. Freddie stays in another room on the second floor. Leonard has a bedroom set up in what used to be the dining room on the first floor. I carry Leonard to bed at night, carry him from his bed to the deck in the morning. We eat breakfast on the deck. He has sores in his mouth and all he wants is bread and water. He has trouble taking it down. We play cards. We watch baseball games, sports highlight shows. We rent movies. Leonard has a list of movies he wants to see before he's gone. The Graduate, The Bridge on the River Kwai, E.T., The Extraterrestrial, Annie Hall, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We go out to a couple of gay bars. We go at night. We go to bars that are quieter, where they have seating Leonard can't stand up for very long. He drinks water, dances in his seat to the music, talks to the other men,
flirts with them, kicks me under the table when I tell him I think one of them likes him. We take the convertible for drives through Marin late at night. We drive with the top down. Leonard stares at the hills, the trees, the vineyards, the stars, the moon, the sky. We make crank calls, pick up the phone, dial random numbers, start speaking absolute gibberish to whoever answers. They always hang up on us. We laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. I take him to San Francisco's art museum. It's early. We're the first ones in line. He has trouble walking. I hold his hand as we wander through the galleries. He cries when we leave. He asks me about my work. I tell him I hate it. He laughs, says, "You have discovered the ventriloquist that hides behind Hollywood's doll." I tell him, "No, I hate what I do because I went to Los Angeles to make some money so that I could try to write a book, and somewhere along the way I got lost." He says, "Quit, write a book." I tell him it's not that easy, I have bills and responsibilities. He laughs again and says, "It is that easy, quit your fucking job and write a fucking book." He asks about Allison. I tell him that we still love each other, but we're through. He asks if there's anyone else. I say, "Maybe." He asks who. I tell him about one of my neighbors. Her name is Maya. We're friends, but nothing more. He says he likes the name Maya. It's a noble, beautiful name. We go to the beach at sunset. He sits, wrapped in blankets, shivering. I offer to take him home. He says no, he wants to stay. We watch the waves crash. We listen to the wind scream. We watch the sun go down. We watch the sun go down. Leonard asks me if there's anything I need to know before he dies. I think about it for a minute, turn to him, say, "What's the meaning of life, Leonard?" He laughs, says, "That's an easy one, my son. It's whatever you want it to be." We finished dinner. We ordered Chinese. Leonard hardly ate. He eats less and less every day. Leonard seems distant, distracted. I ask him if he's okay.
"I was thinking about my friend Andrew."
"Who's he?"
"He was my lover."
"Your lover?"
"Yeah, my lover."
I laugh. "The person you fell in love with?"
"Yeah."
"You should call him your boyfriend, not your lover."
"Why?"
"Lover is cheesy." Leonard laughs.
"You better watch out."
"Why?"
"You're not allowed to call me cheesy."
"I am if you use the word lover."
"How many years have I been listening to you wax poetic about your various girlfriends? Oh, I love her, and I can't live without her. Oh, she's so beautiful. Oh, her eyes, her eyes, her eyes."
I laugh. "A lot of years."
"I'm going to call him my lover, Cheddar Boy, and you're not going to say shit about it."
I laugh again. "Okay, Leonard. Call him whatever you want."
"My lover."
"Where is he?"
"Across town."
"Really?"
"Yeah."
"Why don't you see him?"
"I don't want to."
"Why?"
"It hurts too much."
"Why?"
"Because love hurts sometimes. And it hurts more if you know it's not going to work out."
"How do you know it wasn't going to work out?"
"Look at me. It wasn't going to work out."
"Who is he?"
"Just a guy. He's a lawyer. He's a little older than me."
"A lawyer?"
"A lawyer. A corporate lawyer. He does work for technology companies."
"And older?"
"I like older men. They make me feel young."
I laugh. "How'd you meet?"
"Freddie and I went out to dinner. He was sitting alone at a table. We asked him to join us."
"Love at first sight?" Leonard smiles.
"Yes."
"First time?"
"No. But the first time I ever did anything about it."
"What happened?"
"We ate dinner. He gave me his card. I called him the next day and asked him out. We ate dinner again that night. We talked about art, books, about each other's lives, about our childhoods. He grew up in an upper-middle-class family in San Diego, and spent his childhood surfing and playing Little League. He came back here with me that night and stayed with me. We had dinner, and he stayed with me every night for the next 2 weeks.
And then?
I sent him away. Told him not to call or ever come back here.
Why?
Leonard starts to tear up.
I'm already in too much pain. I didn't want to hurt that way anymore.
I'm sorry.
Leonard stares at the floor, starts to cry, starts to sob. I sit next to him, hug him, let him sob in my arms. It's morning. I get out of bed, walk downstairs. In the week I have been here, we've established a routine. I wake Leonard up, help him brush his teeth, wash his face, shave, help him out to the veranda, where I drink coffee and he drinks water. Leonard isn't in his room. I walk out to the deck. He's sitting on his chair. He's smoking a cigar, staring out across the backyard. He speaks.
My son.
What's going on, Leonard?
Sitting here, enjoying the morning, smoking a fine cigar.
Big day ahead?
You could say that.
You got plans?
You could say that.
Where's Freddy?
He'll be here in a little while. I told him I needed some time alone with you.
What's up? He turns to me.
You still think about Lily?
Of course, every day.
What do you think about when you think about her?
I remember our time together. How she felt when I held her. How she kissed me. How she smiled. What her laugh sounded like. I remember holding her when she'd cry. I remembered talking to her and writing her in jail. I think a lot about what our life might have been like. I invent scenarios that we would have experienced together. Sometimes I think about what it must have been like for her when she died. What she was thinking and feeling. Why she did it.
Why do you think she did it?
She felt too much pain. She just couldn't deal with it.
And how do you feel about what she did?
A small part of me still hates her for it. A part of my heart is still broken. Most of me accepts that she did what she did because she thought it was right, and I respect her decision. He nods, looks back across the yard. He takes a drag of his cigar, exhales, puts the cigar out in an ashtray.
That was a great cigar.
I smile. Good.
My last one.
You want me to get you more?
I mean, it's the last one I'll ever smoke.
Why? He stares at me for a moment.
I'm going to ask you to respect the decision I'm making.
What are you talking about, Leonard?
I'm in too much pain, my son. I don't want to waste away anymore. I want to go out on my terms, with some dignity, before I turn into a wailing, delirious, drugged-up skeleton.
Don't do this.
We've had a good time here together. And this has probably been the best week of my life. It's only gonna get worse. And I'm not gonna let it.
No.
Are you going to respect what I'm going to do?
I shake my head.
No. Please understand this, and respect it. And accept it, the same way you did with Lily.
No fucking way, Leonard. You're not gonna kill yourself. He stares at me, into my eyes. They are the only part of him that still has life. He stares at me. Stares at me.
Please, my son. It's time for me to go.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to ask you to take Bella out for a walk. Stay away for a couple of hours. When you come back, I'll be gone.
I shake my head. No way, Leonard.
I have a bottle of pills. They're pain pills that I received to deal with what's happening to me. I'm going to take the entire bottle. I'll go to sleep, and I won't hurt anymore.
Please, Leonard. No.
I'm not doing this to hurt you. You're the most important person in my life. The only person I've got in this world. The only person I love. You're my son. My motherfucking son. And I'm proud of you. And who you've become and how you conduct yourself. And I know you don't believe in this, but I'll continue to watch over you. And protect you. And I'll look forward to seeing you again.
He stares at me, into my eyes. He opens his arms.
Give me a hug, my son.
I step forward, let him hug me, start to cry. I don't want this to happen, and I don't want to let it happen. I don't want to lose my friend, my best friend, the man who saved me, who helped me, guided me, protected me, watched over me, took care of me. I don't want him to die. I don't want him to die. I don't want him to die. He pushes me away. I don't want to let go of him. He pushes me away.
Be proud. Be strong. Live honorably and with dignity. You can do anything you want to do. You're my motherfucking son. Always remember that. Always remember that.
Tears stream down my face. I'm having trouble breathing. My hands are shaking. I'm scared, in shock. I can't believe this is happening. He stares at me, into my eyes. I'm scared, in shock. I can't believe this is happening. I speak. I don't want this to happen. He chuckles.
I don't want this to happen either, but
I interrupt him. I don't want this to happen. I'm scared, in shock. I start to cry. I start to sob.
No, 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 no.
He stares at me. I look at him. I sob. I'm scared, in shock. I don't want this to happen. Please, 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 God, if you exist, save him. Save him. Save him, and I will devote my life to you. Please, someone, anyone, stop this. Please, just stop this. I sob. Please, please, please. Leonard leans over, puts his arm around me. He hugs me as I sob. Hugs me as I sob. He waits until I stop sobbing. He speaks.
If you're gonna cry, cry because of all the good times we had, and all the laughs, and all the fun shit we did, and cry because those memories make you happy.
I look up at him. He speaks.
We had good years, my son. Great years. The best of my life.
He stands. He takes my hand. I stand and we look at each other for the last time. The last time. He speaks.
It's time now.
I start to cry again.
You gotta leave me. It's time.
I get Bella, leave the house. As I walk, my legs give. I fall. I can't get up. I can't move. I sit on the grass, and I sob uncontrollably, sob uncontrollably, sob uncontrollably, sob. When I can, I get up, and I walk to my truck, and I get inside, and I close the windows, and lock the doors, and lie in the back seat, and I hug my dog, my little dog Bella, and I sob uncontrollably, sob. Freddy knocks on the window. I'm still in the back seat. I don't know how much time has passed. I'm exhausted, spent. I don't want to move, can't begin to comprehend what's happened, can't begin to comprehend what's in that house, can't begin to comprehend that my friend Leonard is gone. My friend Leonard is gone. I can't get out of the car. I feel safe in it, feel protected. I can't stop sobbing. Freddy calls an ambulance. It comes. They remove the body. I can't see it. Can't look as they take him away. I sit in the back seat and I sob, uncontrollably sob. Freddy brings me food I can hardly eat. He takes Bella for walks. When it gets dark, I get out of the car, go inside. As soon as I step through the door, I start crying again. I walk straight up to my room, I lie in bed, and I cry. It's morning. I'm awake. I'm so tired I can hardly move. I go downstairs. Freddy has coffee and cigarettes. We drink the coffee and smoke the cigarettes and cry together. We start cleaning the house, boxing up Leonard's belongings. There isn't much. A few clothes, a few art books, a few pairs of slippers. We throw away medical supplies. We eat lunch. I tell Freddy stories about Leonard. We laugh between tears. We clean. We eat dinner. We laugh between tears. I cry myself to sleep. I wake up, coffee and cigarettes. Freddy gives me the number of a lawyer who set up Leonard's estate. Leonard asked Freddy to give me the number after he was gone. I call the lawyer, make an appointment for the afternoon. I go see the lawyer. It's not Andrew, the lawyer. It's a probate lawyer. He has an oak desk, oak walls. He wears a gray suit. Has a gray-haired assistant who calls me Mr. Fry. He tells me that Leonard has left two trusts. One of them, which is for me, has a significant sum of money in it. I tell him I don't want it, that I want to give it to the institution where we met. He tells me it is a sum of money large enough so that I will never have to work again, never have to worry about money again. I tell him I don't want it, that I would like him to do whatever he needs to do so that the money goes to the institution where we met. He nods. He tells me that the other trust is set up so that a pair of graves in Chicago will always be tended and will always have fresh roses. I ask him how long that will continue to go on. He looks at some papers, looks back at me, says the instructions state there is a sum of money in place so that the graves will be tended for as long as the city of Chicago exists. I start to cry again. I sit in the lawyer's office and I cry. I'm doing the last of the packing. Cleaning. The doorbell rings. I walk to the door, open it. Snapper is standing in front of me. I'm terrified, absolutely fucking terrified. I think about slamming the door, but no, it won't make a difference. If he is here to hurt me, the door won't stop him. He speaks. Hey, kid. What's up, Snapper?
Not much. You?
You're a few days late. He shakes his head.
No, I'm not.
Leonard's already dead.
I've known where he was for the last 6 months. I never would have hurt him. He was a great man. The greatest I've ever known. I'm here to pay my respects.
I step aside. Come on in. Snapper comes in, says hi to Bella, gives her a pat on the head. He asks if there's any alcohol in the house. There's a liquor cabinet. I look inside of it, tell him it's stocked. He asks for a scotch on ice and a glass of ice water. I get two glasses, get the ice, pour the scotch, pour the water. I give him the drink. He tells me to keep the water. He asks to see the place where Leonard passed. I take him out to the deck.
He reaches into his pocket, takes out 2 cigars, speaks.
Before he quit drinking, he drank scotch. After he quit drinking, he drank water. These are Cubans. They were his favorite. Let's smoke and drink in honor of our friend.
I smile. We toast. Light the cigars. Snapper asks me about Leonard's last days. I tell him. He says he wishes he could have been here with us. He asks where Leonard is now. I tell him he's being cremated, that I'm picking up his ashes tomorrow. He looks at me, speaks.
I thought that's what he'd do. That's good.
Why?
There's something you and I need to do.
What?
Can you get Bella back to Los Angeles and have someone take care of her down there?
Probably.
Why?
He tells me why. Tells me what we're going to do. We find Freddy. I introduce him to Snapper. I can see fear on his face. I tell him everything's cool, that Snapper has come to pay his respects. I ask Freddy if he can take Bella to Los Angeles. He says he's not sure. Snapper takes a roll of $100 bills from his pocket, asks him if $5,000 will make him sure. Freddy asks why. We tell him. He agrees to do it for free.
The three of us go out for a steak dinner together. We order more food than we can eat. Snapper and Freddy drink a $500 bottle of wine. We leave a huge tip. In honor of our friend.
End. I teach Freddy how to drive my truck. I give Bella a big kiss. She licks my face. They drive away. Snapper and I pick up Leonard's ashes. They're in a box. We put the box in the back seat of the white convertible, and we buy an Atlas, and we start driving east. We drive across California into Nevada. We drive through Utah, cross the mountains into Wyoming. We keep the top down. We drive fast. We take turns at the wheel, switch every few hours. Night comes, Snapper sleeps. I drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and drive. Morning comes, I sleep, Snapper drinks coffee and smokes cigars and drives. We drive through Nebraska and Iowa and Illinois. We drive through Chicago. We've been driving for 32 straight hours. We switch back and forth. One drives, one sleeps. We stop for food and coffee, cigarettes and gas. We keep driving. The Mercedes is a strong car. We drive 11 more hours through Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. We drive into New York. We're both tired, spent. It's early morning. We're almost there. We keep driving into Connecticut. Snapper knows where we're going, has driven past the entrance with Leonard too many times without going in. This time will be different. We approach a wooded drive. There's a sign out front. We pull up to the drive. Snapper's behind the wheel. He turns to me, speaks.
You ready?
I smile.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Ask Leonard if he's ready. I turn around, look at the box, speak.
You ready, Leonard?
I stare at the box for a moment, look back at Snapper. He says he's been waiting for this day for a long fucking time. Snapper smiles. We start moving down the drive, through the woods. We come out, there's a parking lot to our left, filled with Mercedeses and BMWs, Jaguars and Porsches. There's a Rolls sitting apart in a corner. To our right, there's a clubhouse, a beautiful, sprawling white building with a columned entrance and a valet station. Spread out behind the clubhouse, there's a golf course. We can see sparkling dew on the grass. We pull up to the valet. A uniformed attendant steps forward. Snapper steps out of the car. I step out of the car. I reach into the back seat and I pick up the box. The attendant looks at Snapper, speaks.
May I help you?
Snapper takes a bill from his pocket, hands it to the attendant.
Put it in the lot. Make sure it gets a good spot.
Are you playing golf?
We are.
Do you have clubs?
That's not for you to worry about.
Just make sure the car gets put in a good spot.
The attendant nods, gets in the Mercedes, the last of Leonard's many white Mercedeses, and he drives it into the parking lot. We step toward the front door. There's another uniformed attendant at the door. He looks at us. We've been driving for the last 2 days. We don't look like we're here for golf. He speaks. The service entrance is around back. We step forward. I have the box in my arms. Snapper speaks.
Is this the front door?
Yes.
We're going to walk through it.
The attendant speaks. Excuse me, sir. Snapper interrupts. We're not here to cause trouble. We just need to go through that door.
It can be difficult or easy. Either way, we're going through it. I would highly recommend you make it easy, because if you don't, I will make your life very fucking difficult. Once we're through, you're not going to notify or call anyone. And we'll be gone within 30 minutes. Is that understood?
The attendant looks scared. He nods, speaks.
Yes, sir.
Snapper reaches into his pocket, hands him a bill.
Thank you.
The man takes the bill. Snapper looks at him.
You normally open the door for people?
Yes, sir.
Then do it for us.
The man opens the door.
Thank you.
We walk through the door, enter a foyer. There are beautiful polished dark wood floors, a mirror, an oak reception table with a huge bouquet. There is subtle flowered wallpaper. A hall stretches out in front of us. We walk down it. Ahead of us, there is a large room with couches, tables, chairs. A wall of windows looks out onto the golf course. We walk straight ahead, through the room. There are sets of French doors. We open them, walk outside. It's a beautiful morning. Sunny, crisp, clear. It'll be hot later, but it isn't now. There's a pro shop and cart station to our left, 50 yards away. Without speaking, we both start walking toward it. There's a putting green in front of it. There are 3 men on it lining up putts. Snapper looks at me, speaks.
Let's follow the rules while we're here.
We walk around the putting green, walk up to the cart station. A young man steps out from the station, asks if he can help us. Snapper steps into a cart, gets behind the wheel. He looks at the young man, speaks.
We're taking this cart. You can pick it up in the parking lot in a little while. If you try to tell me I can't take it, I'll knock your fucking teeth out. And if you call anyone and tell them we've taken it, I'll do much, much worse.
The young man nods, speaks.
Understood.
Snapper hands him a bill, speaks.
Thank you.
He turns to me, speaks.
You ready?
I nod, speak. This one's for Leonard. Snapper smiles, speaks.
This one's for Leonard.
He turns the key, steps on the pedal, we pull away. We drive straight through the course. We drive down the middle of the fairways. We ignore the golfers who are surprised by us, who yell at us, who ask us what we're doing. As we pull away, I open the box, and as we drive, we take turns reaching into the box and spreading the ashes. We put ash on every tee, on every fairway, on every green. We spread our friend Leonard across the perfect, beautiful green grass of the golf course that he spent his life dreaming of playing, just like one of the members. With each handful of ash, we say, "This is for you, Leonard," and both of us have tears running down our faces the entire time. We spread Leonard's ashes, our friend Leonard's ashes, our magnificent friend Leonard's ashes. When we finish, we pull the cart into the parking lot. We get out. We start walking down the drive that led us here. We leave Leonard's Mercedes in the parking lot, right where it belongs, right where it will stay until someone takes it away. We walk silently. For the first time in a long time, we are both without some semblance of our friend.
We have left him where he belongs, and where he will stay. When we reach the end of the drive, Snapper takes a phone out of his pocket, calls a taxi service. When he's finished with the call, we sit on the ground and wait. Neither of us speaks. We just sit and wait. 10 minutes later, two cabs arrive. We stand. Snapper looks at me, speaks.
I guess this is it, kid.
I guess so. He reaches into one of his pockets, takes out a card, hands it to me.
That's Olivia's business card. I wrote my number on the back.
I feel like an asshole. I didn't ask you about Olivia, how she's doing.
She's good. I'm trying to convince her to marry me.
Tell her I said hi, and that I said you're not as bad as you seem, and that I think she should marry you. He laughs.
You call me if you ever need anything, or if I can ever help you in any way.
I smile. I probably won't. He smiles.
That's probably best.
Thank you, Snapper.
Thank you, kid.
We give each other a hug. We separate. Snapper speaks.
You going back to Los Angeles?
I'm going to stop in Chicago for a few hours.
Visit your girl?
I gotta tell her Leonard's coming to see her.
He's probably with her already.
I hope so. Snapper looks at me for a moment, nods, opens the door to one of the cabs, gets inside. It pulls away as I get into the other cab. The cabbie looks at me, speaks.
Where are you going?
Airport.
Which one?
LaGuardia.
Where are you headed?
I'm going to see a friend.
Then I'm going home.
The end. You've been listening to My Friend Leonard by James Fry, narrated by Andy Paris and directed by Karen Zippler. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.